Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here with you all. The reason I chose this topic about feeling tone is related to the course that's going to be offered next year, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness as Applied to Addiction Recovery, that kind of thing. And this is a traditional teaching. It's certainly not officially anything to do with addiction recovery. I'm sort of applying it that way. But as we know, feeling tone, well, I'll get into this as we get on into the talk, but feeling tone and craving are closely related. And so it's a topic that I find really fruitful for people in recovery to talk about and explore. So and seemed like a good topic for tonight because it's appropriate for all practitioners. You certainly don't have to be in recovery to take a look at this. We'll get into it here in a minute. So but first of all, just happy to be back at Cambridge Insight CIMC. Wish it could be in person. That would be lovely. I have taught there in person. I guess I did a day long a while ago before the pandemic. And I spend a lot of time coming through Cambridge on my way from where I live in Berkeley, California, to Barre, Massachusetts. So then the other thing for IMS, and what I also wanted to mention is I owe a great debt of gratitude to Bhikkhu Anālayo, who was mentioned as one of my influential teachers. But a lot of the teachings I'm going to touch on tonight come through his work, because I've been a facilitator for his course, the Satipatthana course, through the Barre Center for Buddhist Studies for a couple years now. So I've done four groups. And as a result, I've just sort of keep going through his material. And Satipatthana is the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, if you're not familiar. It's one of these key suttas that offered a whole path of, you know, mindfulness practice that we can follow that's sort of prescribed by the Buddha. And so there are four foundations, and the one we're going to talk about tonight is actually the second foundation of mindfulness. The first one is mindfulness of the body, which gets into a lot more than just the physical body, but talks about contemplation of death and contemplation of the body as elements, the body as parts, 32 parts of the body. So there's different aspects of that one. And then the second one is this feeling tone, the Pali word, P-A-L-I, the ancient Indian language that we refer to a lot in this insight meditation tradition and early Buddhism. The word is Vedana, V-E-D-A-N-A, which can be called feelings or feeling tone, hedonic tone. And I've heard sensations is another translation sometimes used, but that can be, a lot of these can be misleading. So we'll get into this a little more. The third foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of mind or mind states, knowing if there's greed in the mind, knowing if there's anger in the mind or not, these kind of things. And then the fourth one is mindfulness of dhammas, which just there are various teachings in different lists, and it kind of gets into the lists like the Four Noble Truths. So I wasn't going to talk about the whole four foundations of mindfulness, but I wanted to give a broad overview, and then we'll kind of go back to our main topic of Vedana, feeling tone. I kind of like using the, I hope it's not obnoxious, but I like using the Pali term Vedana, because it's, you know, these English words are all kind of trying to get at the approximate definition, but we'll just, it's almost easier to say the Pali term. I'll go back and forth between Vedana and feeling tone. And so there's kind of just, I've just learned so much through this, teaching this course, facilitating this course that Bhikkhu Anālayo is really the main teacher for, as I mentioned earlier. And it's the basic idea is that all of our experience, first of all, it happens at the sense doors. The Buddha has said at some point, you want to know the world, I'll give you the world. It's simply, you know, eyes and seeing, ears and hearing, nose and smelling, you know, tongue and tasting, body and feeling, and mind and thinking, like something along those lines. And so the world happens at these sense doors, and the mind is included as one of the sense doors. And so everything, but when we have contact with something, say even I take a sip of water, there's contact, you know, sense contact. And then I, if I'm paying attention, I will decide, I mean, say that was lemonade, you know, some beverage that I particularly enjoy, then it would be pleasant, you know, I would notice, oh, pleasant sensation arising, pleasant feeling tone at that sense door. With water, it's pretty neutral. So the three main categories here of all of our experience, we either decide it's pleasant, unpleasant, or painful, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant, which we'll call neutral, which is a lot easier to say. But the literal translation of the Pali is neither pleasant nor painful. So, and it all happens on a spectrum, you know, so it's not pleasant has a big range, painful has a big range, and then neutral is, you know, we kind of have to define for ourselves. And the idea with each of these is they actually drive our behavior, which is why it's important to notice them, because we have, so if there's, say, it's lemonade and I really love lemonade, then when I notice and it tastes particularly good, then the craving kicks in and I start wanting more lemonade, you know, and I'll drink a lot of lemonade. But if it's water, it tends to be kind of neutral, and so we may just drink an appropriate amount. And then if it tastes bad, then I may not want to drink anymore, you know, or I'll drink it in tiny little sips if it's medicinal and I think it'll be good for me. But so you get the idea that the feeling tone really can strongly dictate how we react to the contact at the sense door. And so all of this is in the context of mindfulness. So when we're developing a mindfulness practice, these are the kinds of things that we want to sort of study in the lab of our practice. This, you know, Vedana feeling tone. And so feeling tone pops up on a couple of important Buddhist lists, which is why it's also important. One of these is the chain, the 12-link chain of dependent arising. I won't tell you the long Pali term for that, but so this is a really important list because it kind of is what keeps us on the wheel of samsara, keeps us in suffering. And I wasn't going to go into too much detail about it, but I kind of already alluded to it. The key about this is that in the middle of the chain, you have the sense contact, and then you have the feeling tone that arises from there, and then you have craving. So craving arises as a result of the feeling tone. And so we already talked about that, but this is considered the weak link in the chain, right? Where we could break the chain and escape samsara, escape the wheel of suffering that we're kind of stuck on. This is one way of looking at it. So that's why it can be a really important position in that list, you know, the feeling tone. In other words, and there's no intention in feeling tone, which is interesting. Like when something happens that feels pleasant, we don't, it's, this is the uninten, intended first response to something. I talk about Brussels sprouts. When I was a kid, I didn't really prefer Brussels sprouts when they showed up on my plate for dinner or whatever. I just remember that was one of my least favorite. So I would try not to eat them if I could get away with it without, you know, missing dessert or something. So then as an adult, it didn't come up that much. I just didn't order Brussels sprouts on the menu kind of thing. And I didn't cook them at home. But then I started going on these Buddhist meditation retreats, and they serve a lot of vegetables. And one retreat in particular, they just kept serving Brussels sprouts, it seemed like, regularly. And I was kind of skipping them because I, out of pure habit, you know. And then I realized, no, I just need to get the Brussels sprouts. And I kind of was in a more mindful place. And, you know, and so as I just decided to get some Brussels sprouts because I was hungry. And I approached them with a fresh mind. You know, I didn't pre-plan how I was going to feel about them. And then I found that they were they were neutral, slightly pleasant, you know, and they weren't unpleasant at all. And so I'm just saying that I expected them to be unpleasant. It wasn't my intention that they would even be pleasant. You know, I was pleasantly surprised that they were no longer, you get the idea, unpleasant. So this is just this whole area of practice, you can have fun with it, maybe I'm trying to say as well. So especially it seems to come up around, you know, food eating is a good place to notice it, but it happens all the time, you know, in our lives. This is constantly happening. And the Venerable Inalio talks about the push of feeling tone. So, you know, when we're, say, just sitting in the same posture for a while, eventually what was comfortable, eventually the body gets some discomfort. The pleasant becomes unpleasant over time because the body doesn't like to just sit completely still for too long. At some point we'll get some discomfort. And so of course we'll move to try to get comfortable, right? But that was the subtle push of feeling tone that made us move in our chair to try to get a better, more comfortable posture going, you know, to adjust. And then, you know, we have to go to the bathroom when we feel an unpleasant push in the bladder or whatever. So this little feeling tone is pushing us around all day, all the time, and actually has a lot to do with how we behave in the world. And so it's actually very important to pay attention to this so that we're not responding out of reactivity. You might have heard of the dart sutta. There's kind of two darts. The first dart we can't avoid, or also arrows, kind of like dart for some reason, but the first dart we're going to get hit with because life hits us with darts, right? But the second dart is the one that we add to it with our reactivity, like how we react to that first dart. And so we can either, and the Buddha would say an uninstructed worldling just acts, automatically shoots themselves with that second dart, which is kind of the mental reaction to, say, pain in the body. But then an instructed noble disciple, as he would say, knows not to overreact from the first arrow. You know, that we have the mindfulness, the wherewithal, the presence of mind, you might say, to take that first hit and then sort of receive it with awareness and say, oh, okay, I just got hit with a painful dart. Now, how do I want to respond to that, you know, rather than just automatically reacting in some knee-jerk way, we have the freedom to choose wisely how we want to respond to that first dart So this is kind of the idea of the practice here of why this is helpful to see. And, you know, there are many times in life where this will come in handy. I've been on airplane flights, of course, not that much lately. I haven't flown for 2 years or something, but I have pretty broad shoulders, and you're in coach, and I've been in planes where I'm in the middle seat and there's two big guys on either side of me, and basically you're all shoulders are all touching for 5 hour flight or whatever. And I would tend to call that, you know, the first reactive response is like, get me out of here. But I gotta, you know, I do want to get where I'm going. So I gotta learn to live with that sort of what I'm subjectively seeing as unpleasant Vedana of like just sort of being shoulder to shoulder with people I don't know for many hours. I mean, you make it as pleasant as you can, but some people nowadays, they'll have their headphones on and, you know, not look at you the whole time. So you can't really like engage and kind of find a way to relax the situation. So you get the idea. There are lots of experiences in life where it's helpful to have this ability to like to deal with unpleasant Vedana when it arises in a skillful way and not be reactive. And we're going to fail too. And it's actually important to notice as whenever we can, when we fail. Another aspect that I haven't talked about that much is the neutral Vedana. So when that arises and things are just kind of flatliner, not so compelling, then we have a strong tendency to want things to be more interesting, more entertaining than they are in that moment, right? So we will go to pretty extreme lengths sometimes just to get out of the what we're perceiving as boring, neutral Vedana, you know, rather than cultivating, say, patience in the moment and just being with what is. And I guess I can tell this story of myself. I was stuck in a parking lot, a crowded parking lot today, behind a car who was waiting for another car to pull out. But the other car seemed to just, there was definitely somebody in the car, but they were not pulling out. And it just felt like an eternity that they were never going to pull out. So I started to think maybe this, and I couldn't back up and I couldn't go forward. And I was a little bit pressed for time. So I kind of decided to honk to see if I could move things along one way or the other. And of course, I wish I hadn't done that, but I did. And, you know, it was that neutral Vedana. I was like, this is, but, you know, I guess there was an unpleasant Vedana of wanting to get parked and then get to where I needed to go. But, yeah, so we will occasionally act out, but then to look, and I will say that then I ended up, there were two parking spots that opened up, so I had to park next to the person I'd honked behind. And then we got out of their cars at the same time. And this very lovely woman said, it's rude to honk in that situation. And I just had to, you're so right. I really apologize. That wasn't great. So yeah, we're not gonna be perfect at this, but the point being that we can learn to be more skillful. Just don't follow my example in that moment. So, let's see. We also have to have a sense of humor about ourselves, because we are going to screw up sometimes. We are going to do the unskillful thing. And that's, as long as we don't harm anybody, hopefully, just kind of learn to live with that. So there are some different quotes I thought I might read. We'll see. Well, one thing, so Bhikkhu Anālaya in one of his books says, training oneself in recognition of these three feeling tones that we've been talking about and the type of reaction they tend to trigger enables an honest recognition of what really motivates one's behavior, of the how and why of one's reactions to the ups and downs of life, that effective push. He talks about, for example, being in a particular posture will sooner or later lead to a slight feelings of discomfort. So we talked about that already. He has this phrase, allow for mindful inspection before getting into action. Allow for mindful inspection before getting into action. And it's said of the Buddha that he experienced the taste of food, but didn't experience craving for the taste, which is, I guess, the kind of high bar that we're looking at. So it's not that you can't enjoy things by any means. That is not the point. The point is simply to not get caught by craving for more of it in some kind of way that could lead to, harm or overeating or addictive behavior or whatever it is. And so the Buddha, after his awakening, was able to just, he experienced the taste of food in a very rich, enjoyable way, but he just never got caught in the craving. That the craving no longer arose in his mind once he had that awakening experience. Now the other thing that Venerable Anālaya talks about is how with Vedana there's both worldly and unworldly feeling tone. And the worldly is kind of what we've been talking about. So the usual feeling tones that arise as a result of, eating, drinking, whatever happens to our body at the sense doors, these kinds of things. And the unworldly is tends to be more kind of what happens on the cushion, like when you're meditating. It's a more meditative quality of feeling tone that you can experience. For example, when you're meditating, you can have a very it's called piti, P-I-T-I. This experience of rapture or joy can arise up through your body, and it's very pleasant. And this would be called an unworldly feeling tone that arises. That's that the Buddha considered sort of a desirable feeling tone to go for. So in a way, what we're also learning to do is remove the emphasis on worldly feeling tones, which kind of drives the world at large, and we're moving towards the unworldly, towards valuing the unworldly feeling tones more. And the good news here is that the unworldly feeling tones include, these very pleasant experiences of rapture, joy, being one of them. The other thing that we find is that unworldly neutral feeling tones are in some ways the best of the best because there's absolutely no agitation in the mind if you have an unworldly neutral feeling tone. And for this is the kind of height of this. One version would be the fourth jhana. So there's the absorptions and meditative absorptions, these deep states of meditation that we can get into with a lot of practice, usually on a long retreat. And the fourth jhana, fourth absorption, is kind of characterized by pure equanimity. So it's just a very sort of beautiful sense of peace and calm and just equanimity, where equanimity towards everything. We're just in a it's hard to describe, to be honest. Words kind of fail, but it would be a neutral yet worldly feeling tone that If you experience it, it's just there's just no agitation in the mind, which just allows the mind to be very at ease. It's like a real deep sense of ease that's very, very, it sort of becomes pleasant in its neutrality. It's hard to describe. But then also it said that after awakening, you would have that kind of unworldly, neutral feeling tone, if I recall correctly. But and there's also unworldly, painful feeling tone, which tends to center around realizing that we're not liberated yet and we would like to be. And so there's this like sort of unpleasant feeling of like, darn, what can I do to find the real freedom and peace that the Buddha was pointing us to? And so we can have, and the point of the unworldly is it keeps us forward on the path. It keeps us on the Noble Eightfold Path, keeps us motivated to practice. And of course, the worldly, say, painful feelings can also keep us motivated to practice if we have the right attitude towards them. So let's see. There, I hope this is all fairly making sense. And well, another thing that Bhikkhu Anālaya talks about is just how he feels that this, and I've seen other scholars until recently, there's been a sense that this particular aspect, the second Satipatthana, hasn't really been emphasized in practice maybe enough or as much as it could be. And there hasn't been as much written about it. So you'd see it kind of not written about as much. But lately there have been a number of new books coming out. I didn't have time to read the ones I wanted to before this talk even. So there is starting to be more, if this is a subject you find compelling, there are more. And Bhikkhu Anālaya just came out with his own new book called Deepening Insight, Teachings on Vedana in the Early Buddhist Discourses. So even he has recently published a new book on this topic. And there's, you know, the other thing to say about Vedana is it's very impermanent and ephemeral. And so it's considered a really good doorway into seeing impermanence, because it's compared to like bubbles on water during rain. You know, if it's raining and the bubbles form on the surface of the water, but they're very fleeting. Like as soon as they appear, they, you know, disappear almost. So, and feeling tones can kind of be that ephemeral. They come and go quite quickly. And as we tune into them, we can, you know, so in the Satipatthana course, he has these guided meditations with body scans, and he'll have you just scan your body for pleasant feeling tone from the head down through the body to the feet, just looking for any pleasant feeling tone that you can detect. And then you do that with each of the other two. So that would be one way to work with this in your practice if you wanted to try that. And I think it's a useful exercise. I don't do it every time I meditate by any means, but it's good. And I mean, I sometimes talk about how this has been helpful in parenting, because with parenting, with having especially a baby, you know, anything can happen when you're holding a baby. They might throw up on you or pee on you or, you know, these different things. And so it's good not to be reactive if you, but also what I noticed about that is if somebody else peed on me, I think I'd have a very strong, unpleasant vedana. But when my daughter did, it just felt warm. You know, you just felt the warmth of it or something. And the warm, you know, that could even be called pleasant feeling tone. But at the very least, it was all pretty neutral feeling tone when something like that happened, or she spit up some from too much milk or something on my shoulder or whatever it was. So that was kind of interesting too, that things that I would have assumed were going to be unpleasant feeling tone with holding a baby weren't really at all. It was, maybe there's just so much kind of like love there that it overrides the sense of an unpleasant feeling tone. I don't know. But I felt like having practiced with this was helpful, or has been helpful as a parent in many ways. I do think this is a very practical teaching that can help us throughout our daily life. I'm kind of running through my materials so fast. I'm kind of trying to think of more things to share about all this. I mean, just to reiterate that mindfulness really is the key here. That first we have to establish mindfulness, and then we can start investigating these feeling tones. The Buddha talked about how sort of untrained worldlings were easily overcome by both pleasant and painful feelings. And that's definitely us until we have a practice. And even then, we can still honk at people in the parking lot or whatever. So it's a work in progress. And let's see, the other thing is that we can, well, other another aspect of the practice is looking at internal and external feelings. And so in some ways, it's been helpful in relationship to, not only am I aware of my own tendency to respond, react to feeling tone, but when we realize that everybody else is dealing with that too, then we can sort of understand where people are coming from. You could say we start to understand conditionality better as to why somebody might be angry or sad or whatever it might be, that usually it's a response to a feeling tone that might have happened that sort of led to that. So that tends to be the underlying thing happening that causes the strong emotion to arise. And so this gives us a sort of base to really see where that's coming from, and that can be very helpful. Part of the practice too is to watch whenever we can the arising and the passing away of feeling tone. So it's very helpful to notice when the feeling tone arises. So you might be meditating and you might have an itch on your arm arise. And what's interesting is that's a good place to notice that strong push of feeling tone. It kind of screams at us to do something, the itch is happening. But we don't have to scratch it. It's not gonna cause a problem if we don't, right? And when we're meditating, we may be committed to not moving too much. So often we will sit through that unpleasant feeling tone of the itch, and lo and behold, it's gone in a matter of seconds or minutes, or it doesn't tend to last very long. So we can really see impermanence there and just kind of work with seeing the arising and passing away. And the Buddha talked about how all conditioned phenomenon arise and pass away. And it's just good to get a sense of that through observing feeling tone. And so that's a useful thing. And then the other list, I think I didn't get to this yet, but so talked about how feeling tone is on the list for the 12-link chain of dependent arising. It's also on the list of the five aggregates of clinging. These are the things that we tend to cling to the most, that are kind of make up our experience in the world. And that would be the materiality, nama rupa. The first one is basically our body, the physical form. And then the other four are mental aggregates, and it starts with feeling tone, perception, volitional formation, or kind of intention, motivation, maybe, and then lastly, consciousness. And so Bhikkhu Anālayo, in one of his books, says, has this passage where he says, in the listing of the five aggregates, feelings are placed right after the body and before the other mental aggregates. This positioning may well reflect the intermediate role that feelings have within the context of subjective experience. Due to whatever sense door a pleasant or painful feeling may have arisen, its actual experience will affect the body as well as the mind. Feelings can thus be seen as an intermediary between body and mind, having a conditioning effect in both directions. So he calls this the bridge. Feeling tone is kind of the bridge between body and mind. And I think this is also an interesting point he makes, that this is, and then so in the four satipatthanas, the four foundations of mindfulness, it starts with the body, mindfulness of the body. Then you have mindfulness of feeling tone, and then we move to mindfulness of mind. So it's right there in the middle in that list as well. So just kind of useful to see how that works. So the mind can influence how the body takes things that happen to it, and the body can influence how the mind responds to things that happen to it. I'm trying to think of good examples, but hopefully you get the idea. I just have found this to be an interesting part of the teaching as well to keep in mind. So let's see, probably open it up for questions in a little while. Just want to make sure I'm hitting all my key points here. Let's see, another thing that Bhikkhu Anālayo talks about is how, in addition to noticing the subtle pain inherent in having a body, sustained practice of the present of the contemplation of feeling tone also reveals what he calls the subtle joy of being in the present moment, which is usually not noticed because our minds tend to be distracted to a level where we don't really notice it. But when we're really practicing mindfulness, and probably over some period of time before we really get to notice this, but we start to have this sense of this subtle joy that comes in when we're really present. We're really kind of like the practice is cooking a little, and we can really be with experience and not distracted. It's kind of that sense that the mind isn't distracted. And I'm actually really here. Because, we spend a lot of our lives, I know I did anyway, I was pretty distracted for many, many years. And this practice has really allowed me to enjoy this, what he calls the subtle joy of being in the present moment. And it's, he sort of points to this as it's like a reliable form of joy that we can bring into our lives that the practice gives us. And the Buddha was always kind of saying, be a light or be an island unto yourselves, be a refuge unto yourself. And in some sense, this is one of these, one way we can have this refuge where we can really start to value this subtle joy of just being in the present moment. There's a Zen saying, just to be alive is enough, And maybe we would say just to be present is enough, I don't know. But it's certainly nice way of being in the world when we can really be kind of continuously mindful rather than continuously distracted. And again, it takes a lot of practice and dedication, but you can start to value that experience more and more. Dr. Judson Brewer, Judd Brewer, has spoken at CIMC, I'm pretty sure. And he talks about the bigger, better offer. He works with people who are battling with addictions. He's done studies helping people get off of cigarettes, smoking cessation using mindfulness. And he talks about the bigger, better offer, BBO. as a way to motivate ourselves to get off of some addictive behavior, we need a bigger, better offer. And Venerable Anolio kind of uses this subtle joy of being in the present moment as one version of a BBO that we can lock into. And he also says that noticing the subtle joy counterbalances the discovery of pain in the body that we start to notice as well when we're practicing on that level, kind of a deeper level, that there is a subtle pain in the body that we might notice. But then the subtle joy kind of counterbalances it. So it's kind of a necessary thing that we want to notice. Yep. So let's see. Just to kind of backtrack, the term Vedana in the Pali is derived from the root vid, whose range of meaning covers both to feel and to know. And Vedana can thus be understood to represent the affective aspect of the process of knowing, the how of experiencing. This is according to Bhikkhu Anolio. So while Vedana has a strong conditioning impact on emotions, it doesn't include emotions in its range of meanings. So that is kind of an important thing that that's why the defining Vedana as feeling is very misleading, because it's not feelings like emotions. Although it might condition emotions, but it's not exactly what we're talking about. And it can be kind of confusing if we forget that. So just a good thing to be aware of, that we're not talking about emotions. That's a more complex concept in early Buddhism in particular, which is kind of what I'm talking about, the early Buddhist understanding, and that would come more in the third Satipatthana under mind, according to Bhikkhu Anolio, and that makes sense to me as well. There are various discourses that talk about feeling with a range of different similes. Sometimes they're compared to winds in the sky, which come from different directions, and at times they can be dusty, hot or cold, mild or strong. And then there's one that's he talks about, it's the guest house. I guess I like this one. It reminds me of the Rumi poem, although it's not the Rumi poem. You might have heard that one, but the guest house one is, I might read a little bit of it. It says, it is just as various types of people who stay in a guest house, this is from ancient India, warriors, Brahmins, householders, people from the countryside, hunters, those who keep the precepts, those who break the precepts, those who live at home, and those who are homeless, all come to stay therein. This body is also just like that guest house. Various types of Vedanas arise one after the other, unpleasant Vedanas, pleasant Vedanas, or neutral Vedanas. Pleasant bodily Vedanas, unpleasant bodily Vedanas, and neutral bodily Vedanas. Pleasant mental Vedanas, unpleasant and neutral mental Vedanas. Worldly pleasant and worldly unpleasant, .. And then it says pleasant Vedana is related to passionate attachment. Unpleasant Vedana is related to passionate attachment. And neutral Vedana is related to passionate attachment. And then the last part, pleasant Vedana is related to renunciation, and unpleasant and neutral Vedana is related to renunciation. So we go from passionate attachment to renunciation, which is kind of the direction that the Buddhism sends us in, that this idea of passionate attachment is what causes our suffering. So we want to let go of passionate attachments and dwell independently without clinging to anything, so that we're not kind of at the mercy of our passionate attachments. So that may be mostly what I wanted to share. I think I will also, because this is not strictly geared towards sort of addiction, but I did have a quote from Dr. Judson Brewer, who I mentioned a few minutes ago. I just kind of like this. It's from something he wrote called Mindfulness and Psychotherapy, Breaking the Addiction Loop. And he says, what the Buddha discovered, simply put, when we come into contact with certain environmental cues, and thoughts are included here, depending on our previous experiences and memories of them, our brains interpret these cues as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. If it's pleasant, we want it to continue. If unpleasant, we want it to stop. Craving leads to clinging or attachment to the object, event, or behavior that perpetuates the pleasant state, giving rise to the birth of an identity around the object through the laying down of a memory. If the state cannot be sustained, which is invariably the case, because all conditioned existence is impermanent, stress and suffering may arise again. Stress feeds back into the cycle, the samsara, by bringing mindful awareness to, and then he says, by bringing mindful awareness to the addictive loop, one can ride out the unpleasant feelings of craving instead of feeding the fire by indulging in the addictive behavior. So this just kind of points to how we could use this in, you know, how they're using it in modern medicine to help people with, say, addiction issues, that ride out the unpleasant feelings that come with the craving for the substance they might be addicted to. But, you know, we can also use this in our lives in other ways. I mean, I have this tendency after dinner to kind of crave some kind of dessert, you know, like with some kind of conditioning from my childhood or whatever. And, but I also was diagnosed with pre-diabetes a few years back. And so one thing I realized is I need to not have, like, especially sugary snacks at night after dinner would not be a good thing for my condition. So, but I still, it doesn't mean that the idea doesn't really appeal to me to have ice cream like after dinner or whatever. And, but I have to sort of ride out those cravings when the idea, when it arises. And, of course, it also helps just don't buy the ice cream. But anyway, you get the idea. There are many ways where we can apply this to our daily lives. And it can, this is kind of part of cultivating wisdom, is seeing, you know, that we give up a lesser happiness for a greater happiness. The Buddha talked about that in the, that's in the Dhammapada. But that is a, sort of the one definition of wisdom, when we're really able to do that on a regular basis. And I know in my life, I'm constantly being sort of required to do this, like finding out you're pre-diabetic, so now you can't enjoy your ice cream after dinner or whatever. There's often things like that. And the practice has helped me deal with that. Another thing that came up was coffee. I was, during the pandemic, I started, you know, making fancy coffee at home, like really getting into the whole coffee experience, home brewing coffee experience. I was already doing it, but I kind of took it to another level of, you know, passionate attachment, as we talked about earlier. And, but then I also realized at some point, noticed that my sleep patterns were really not very, you know, just wasn't sleeping that well at night. And I realized I really needed to eliminate this really strong coffee I was drinking every single day and just to see how that would affect my sleep, assuming it's probably going to help. And, but then I still want, you know, every morning I was so used to this coffee. So, but long story short, I no longer drink regular coffee in the morning, at least for the past 2 or 3 months. And practice helped me, you know, work through that. It really hasn't been that bad. But if I didn't have this practice, I'm not even sure I could have done it because I was so attached to my coffee. So anyway, happy to report I'm sleeping better and things are going well. So thank you for your kind attention. Pleasure to be with you all tonight. And hope to see you another time at CIMC. Thanks, everybody. Take care.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.